From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to remember the unifying legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. And he was not a separationist or a secessionist of any kind. He believed that Americans needed to come together and live together. And with the raise the cup of brotherhood and the standard of brotherhood, as he put it, it is the Martin Luther King holiday. And when you talk about American unity, a lot of people look at our country right now and say our unity has never been more threatened. And you just have to take a look, as we will later this hour, at the marches, the gun rights march that's going on today, which is very, very different from the women's march, which was largely an hysterical bust in 180 different cities across the country over the weekend. Also, looking at the separation of Americans and the divisions that threaten our national unity is the new book, which we've mentioned on the show before, by F.H. Buckley. And he is one of the longtime thoughtful conservative contributors to American discourse. He was actually one of the very early conservative intellectuals to support President Donald Trump for both the nomination and for the presidency. F.H. Buckley is a foundation professor at George Mason University's Scalia School of Law, and he has frequently appeared on CNN, C-SPAN, NPR, Morning Joe, and many other media venues. His new book is called American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. Frank, congratulations on the book, and congratulations on the new grandchild.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and very happy on both occasions. Okay, one of the things that your book does is it puts the whole idea of secession in an international context. Right now, of course, there is a renewed move for Scottish secession from the United Kingdom. The Catalonian drive for independence hasn't gone away. Do we have here in the United States any comparably intense move for separation to drives for secession that have actually, even in Canada and Quebec, there was a few years ago until basically they made some accommodation, the drive for Quebec to be a separate country. We don't have that in the United States, do we?
We don't have it, but my book was a warning about a threat of secession. In other words, I'm not a secessionist, I'm a unionist, looking at a very divided country and wondering what happens next, and in particular, what happens in a year's time if Donald Trump has been reelected and possibly has a few more slots in the Supreme Court to fill. I think the threat of secession this time would come not from conservatives, but from liberals, and would be politically correct. And my book is an argument that it might happen and that perhaps we're too big and there are things to be said in favor of it. And for that reason, we should try to think of things to cool things down and look for alternatives.
Michael Goodwin writes about your book over at the New York Post and talks about secession light as an alternative to actually breaking up the union, which you consistently oppose in American secession. What's secession like light look like?
Well, secession light might come in a number of flavors. What I described was something I called home rule, which was what the Brits offered Ireland in the 1880s, and indeed what the Brits offered America in 1778. And the idea was, look, you know, we kind of get it. You don't like us all that much, but rather than simply complete independence, what are the things short of that? And my argument is, maybe some form of devolution or federalism on steroids would be the way to go. If we're divided in how we feel about government, then maybe we have too much government from Washington.
And again, that's something that you've maintained for a long time. and that most conservatives have believed that everything doesn't need to be some sort of federal diktat.
Well, think about it this way. Think about the people who potentially might welcome secession. I mean, it might include, in particular, people on the woke left who despise people who disagree with them. I mean, you know, that level of rancor we've not seen since 1860. For conservatives who would likely oppose secession, they would start thinking about how, well, for example, people who worry about corruption would, like the Peter Schweitzers of the world, would start thinking about how, you know, the source of corruption is K Street in Washington. People like Philip Hamburger, who think we've got a regulatory state, are really complaining about the code of federal regulations and regulatory overload from Washington. You know, so there's a lot to be, you know, the temptation is there, and that's precisely why we have to think about it, and I hope resist it.
And in terms of you pinpoint California, which is such an overwhelmingly wealthy, dynamic, and populous state. It is not inconceivable that some future left wing California politician could want California to go it alone. I mean, one of the things that you mention in the book, and the book again is called American Secession, is this dispute over mileage standards, which seems to be bizarre. In other words, the fact that California wants to impose different mileage standards on its automobiles than the federal government would with the auto companies. Do you have a problem with California having that right?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, it can do whatever it wants in that respect. I think what we're looking at is basically, you know, companies in free markets figuring out how to sell their cars. I mean, they don't want to exclude California. And, you know, I lived in Canada for most of my life. And, you know, there it was a question of, you know, French on the cornflakes box. And Pierre Trudeau said, if you don't like it, just turn the damn thing around. And so, you know, if California went its own way, you'd have car manufacturers saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to sell our cars there, so we have to comply.
Well, the California might also, and again, this is one of those things that drove Canada's secession movement. And I'm interested in getting your perspective on how Canadians dealt with it successfully. But part of it was linguistic difference. You had a big chunk of people who didn't speak the same language. And we're increasingly in that situation in the United States, no?
Yeah, we are. I don't see us becoming bilingual in the way that America, that Canada is. The Canadian example is useful in a couple of respects. First of all, some people say, no, we don't want to think about secession because that would lead to violence. Well, there was violence in Quebec back in the 60s and the early 1970s, and it completely stopped when a separatist government was elected. In other words, you know, the crazy types who indulge in violence, you know, stop being violent when they realize they might get their own way politically. And the second lesson from Quebec is you know, again, we wouldn't see violence. What got people riled up, the English speakers in Montreal, was something called Bill 101, which basically suppressed English language rights. And the Anglos there called it Bill 401, and 401 is the name of the highway between Montreal and Toronto. So, you know, the effect of secession was about 300,000 English Montrealers moved to Toronto. Okay, and so if there was something like secession in America, basically the big winner would be U-Haul.
Mm-hmm. And maybe Utah for accommodating some of the refugees from the new independent state of California. There are a lot of conservatives, as you acknowledge, who would actually rejoice, don't you think, if Massachusetts, New York, and California decided to secede?
Well, there might be a sense of some people saying, don't let the door hit you on the way out, and maybe...
Or erring sisters go in peace?
Something like that. They might also look at the Electoral College and say, hey, this is going to be a win-win. Exactly, Aaron Sisters depart in peace. So, but, you know, I think the conservative, what would stop conservatives from being secessionists is conservatives are patriots. Although they might figure that the only way to retain their patriotism and their heritage and their cultural symbols would be through secession. I mean, if you value the founders and the wisdom of the founders and the heritage of our country, you know, you might consider them better protected in a divided country rather than have them all erased by cancel culture from Washington.
Okay, this is one of the reasons that, and we've spoken about this before, Frank, is that I disagree with you. I don't really think we have the kind of issues disagreement that could lead to secession. When we had the secession movement before, obviously, with the American South, there was a core issue of slavery, which was a life and death issue, that people had extraordinarily powerful feelings about that. And I know we have differences in terms of gun regulation and differences in terms of approaches to immigration and basically what kind of textbooks there should be, in the public schools. But what would be, you think, the most serious, the most desperate issue driving some kind of separation here?
Well, 2 points. First of all, going back to 1860, the Civil War was well fought to end slavery. But in 1860, the most prominent, you know, anti-slavery voices were William Seward and Abraham Lincoln, both of whom said they would agree to putting a right to slavery permanently in the Constitution. So it became an anti-slavery war, and happily was won on that basis. As for today, you know, it was well to fight a war over slavery, but who wants to fight a war over transgender bathrooms, okay, as a crude way of putting it. But yet there is something else going on. In 1992, Irving Kristol said the culture wars are over, the left won. Well, Trump was elected in 2016, and all of a sudden it became less clear that the left had won the culture wars. And given that for the left, the culture wars have the status of religion, they suffered the way to understand the craziness is to understand the psychic wound that the left suffered when it realized it doesn't own the culture as they thought it did. And that feeling may intensify. Think of those no hate signs that you see everywhere. You know, in my case, the Washington Post arrives in my doorstep each morning, and I see it as each morning a separate argument for secession. I mean, the contempt for people with whom those people disagree is palpable. You know, friendships are broken and you don't talk to people. There's no room for compromise. Congress in Washington is composed of people who just really don't get along with each other at all. There's no attempt to bridge the divide. That resembles 1860.
Well, except that it's not as geographically specific. In other words, Lincoln's name didn't even appear on the ballot in the southern states in the election of 1860. They wouldn't allow it to appear on the ballot. It was an election between Breckinridge and Douglas and John Bell. And even John Bell wasn't on the ballot in some of the southern states. So, but here in this country, there are pockets of conservative feeling, even within the five boroughs of Manhattan, certainly in suburban Washington, D.C., in San Francisco suburb. Well, not so much there. Okay, in the Los Angeles suburbs, there are pockets of conservatism. So isn't that a fundamental difference, that the ideological disagreements are more geographically mixed up?
Yeah, there is a bit of that. But recall how divided much of the South was. I mean, in my Virginia, 3 votes were taken on secession, and the first 2 failed. And prominent unionists included Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson.
And the western states. Part of the state split apart rather than go along with secession.
Right. You know, then you have, you know, the border states of Tennessee and Kentucky. And Lincoln said, "I hope God is on my side, but I must have Tennessee." Then you think about the 2016 electoral map, and it's not just that it was a division between red and blue America, but the reds were deep reds, and the blues were deep reds, deep blues. All right, the places where Trump won 60-70% of the vote are lost by that amount. That's a large part of America. And then again, another possibility that might be on the table is divisions within a state. I mean, if a state can secede, then parts of the state might decide that it doesn't want to go that way. If San Diego is given the choice of remaining with America or going with Los Angeles, I know what it would decide. Orange County as well. Washington State, you've got sharp divisions between people on the eastern side and the western side of the state. So, anything could happen. One of the messages from 1860 is once the genie is out of the bottle, you don't know where you're going.
Well, that could be a situation in the United States. The book is called American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. The author is F.H. Buckley, who teaches at the Scalia Law School at George Mason University. In terms of you're saying you don't know where you're going, I assume you believe, as virtually every sentient observer seems to, that President Trump is not going to be removed from office in this impeachment, and that he is increasingly likely to win re-election. Is that your assumption?
That is my assumption. And, remarkably, the cruder that Trump gets, the more people are willing to tolerate, and the more people, conservatives, Republicans, are willing to tolerate him. And that's a reflection of what they think about people on the other side.
Well, the people on the other side, do you see any Democrat on the horizon who could make this a closely fought battle?
Not really, and I regret that. I mean, I guess I'm regarded as a conservative. I see myself as a JFK liberal, which I guess makes me a conservative today. If Trump won re-election and if he had those extra seats in the Supreme Court, there are one of two possibilities. One, it seems to me, is the left would accept that it didn't quite win the culture wars and might tone things down and be less ready to indulge in the delicious emotion of justified hatred. That's one possibility. The other is a movement towards a breakup.
And that is what is discussed in American Secession by Frank Buckley. In terms of... I was just speaking before you came on with Brett Stevens of the New York Times, who makes the case that Bernie Sanders could actually win this election. If a Bernie Sanders were president of the United States, would you see the likelihood of calls for conservative secession?
I don't think so. I don't think we do that. I mean, we had, frankly, someone a little like that with Obama in 2008. There was no move to secession. Conservatives were disgruntled and happy, but they love the country too much to try to break it up. I don't say I would welcome a Bernie Sanders candidacy, but comparing him to some of the other people over there, I mean, his emphasis, he's kind of losing it now, but in 2016, he emphasized economic issues and not identity politics. And I thought, I like that.
Uh-huh. And that is not the case now. Bernie Sanders has just been caught in a series of contradictions that are fairly remarkable. We will get to that and also the contrast between the Women's March and the Gun Rights March in Richmond, Virginia. That and much more coming up. F.H. Buckley's book, American Secession, is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. The argument that Americans are growing further and further apart, when you listen to some of the highlights and lowlights of these contrasting demonstrations in the last few days, you can understand some of the points that Professor Buckley is making. We will be right back on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, everyone agrees that the Women's March, which peaked at its very first Women's March, which was 2017, right after Trump's inauguration. They did one in 2018 that still had some decent turnout, and then they did one in January of 2019. Now the fourth annual Women's March was largely a bust. There's a headline that I think captures the essence of it, and it's over at the Independent Sentinel. It says, "Mindless blather of the hard left Women's March." And you can hear some of that blather. You can sample it. It's very extreme. And by the way, some of it is not just mindless blather. It's disgusting. They idolize a famous terrorist, Laila Khaled, who was part of a team that hijacked TWA Flight 840 on its way from Rome to Tel Aviv. And she's posed there wearing a keffiyeh and carrying some kind of submachine gun. And come on. And they hold her up. A woman's place is in the struggle. Fight and preach imperialism. And anti-Americanism, which is part of what the Women's March is about. By the way, the story from Seattle's planned Women's March, it was canceled. It was rescheduled from this Saturday, when it was supposed to take place with the other women's marches around the country. It was moved to March 8th. Organizers said they worried winter weather could make the event unsafe or difficult to access. The March 8th event is scheduled for International Women's Day. I know, a sacred day to many. And it will focus on intersectionality and amplifying the voices of women, that's spelled W-O-M-X-N, femme, non-gender conforming people pushed to the margins of society and taking a special focus on supporting youth leaders. Sound exciting? Well, maybe as exciting as this. MSNBC went out to the Women's March and asked one of the participants why. Listen.
Why was it so important for you and the rest of the group here to participate this time around?
I just feel that our voices need to be heard, we need to be seen, and we also need to remember that every vote counts. And so I just feel like the more we show ourselves and the more we raise our voices, the more the concerns of the people can be heard.
And over the years, do you think the movement has been effective?
I think it's a give and take. I believe that sometimes, our voices have been heard and legislation has changed. But other times I feel like there's a minority that's become a louder majority in sound than in people. So I think the silent majority needs to stand up, rise up, and speak our truth and speak our rights as human beings, as American citizens.
Great. All right, Judy, well, thank you so much. As you can see, there are still folks who are very much energized and they want to still press forward with their message.
Yippee. And there were also children who participated, and they didn't exactly use child appropriate language. Listen.
What? Donald Trump! He's stupid!
Okay, that's a wonderful way to introduce your children to the way the American political system works. If you want to understand just how tightly focused and logical these demonstrators were, listen to this summary.
The patriarchy. Donald Trump. Mike Pence. White supremacy. Racism. Misogyny. Homophobia. Transphobia. Capitalism. Classism. Transphobia. Ableism. Islamophobia. Antisemitism. Every kind of bigotry out there.
Okay, and what's brilliant about that achievement of a summary of the purpose of the Women's March was it was done without notes. No, really. And then she explains, same lady, why she is not polite. Listen.
Here in front of the White House, I am not here for polite protest because patriarchy is not polite. I am not here for quiet protest because patriarchy is not quiet. Patriarchy here in Washington, D.C., patriarchy in Cairo, Egypt, where I'm from, patriarchy across the world, the patriarchy in every time zone, and patriarchy in every universe.
In every universe? Uh-huh. There's also this issue of the National Archives. I've never heard of this before, but the National Archives issued an apology. And they issued an apology regarding a photograph from the first Women's March that they had altered. And the photograph had been blown up into huge size. It was like a reproduction of the photograph that was 5 feet by 6 feet in terms, which is a big photograph, occupies a big part of the wall. And it was divided between images of the first Women's March in January 2017 and an old march for female suffrage for the woman's right to vote 100 years ago. And, okay, officials of the National Archives on Saturday announced that they would remove from display an altered photo of the 2017 Women's March in which signs held by marchers that were critical of President Donald Trump had been blurred. Okay, what the sign said was God hates Trump. In tweets Saturday, the museum said, "We made a mistake. As the National Archives of the United States, we are and have always been completely committed to preserving our archival holdings without alteration. And nonetheless, we were wrong to alter the image." What they had done is they had blurred out the name Trump. Now, I don't know why they did that. And I assume they did it to make the march look better. It certainly wasn't to help Trump. Because actually, having these signs with people saying God hates Trump or God hates the GOP, and those signs were blurred out too, that I think is an indication of just how extreme these people were. And the fact that the National Archive blurred it out so you really can't read it, it's outrageous. Marchers in the 2017 photograph taken by Mario Tama of Getty Images were shown carrying a variety of signs, at least four of which were altered by the museum. A placard that proclaims God hates Trump has Trump blotted out so that it reads God hates. A sign that reads Trump and GOP, hands off women, has the name Trump blurted out. GOP, hands off women. This is so stupid. And so is the general dismissal of by the media of the pro-gun rally, the pro-Second Amendment rally, which was peaceful, which was respectful, which was sane. You may disagree with the point the ralliers are making, but I want to get to that because actually some of this broke through to the media to a remarkable extent. Because in Virginia, where there had been so much panic about, oh, there are going to be white supremacists there, and there was an FBI arrest of three people from an organization called The Base. By the way, you know how you say The Base in Arabic? Al-Qaeda. Right. This is not that. This is a neo-Nazi group. And these people were rightly arrested, it seems to me. They're, to the very best of my knowledge, they think they're still demonstrating right now. There was no violence. There were no confrontations with police. Just respectful American citizens standing up, they believe, for their Second Amendment rights. Something wrong with that? 1-800-955-1776. We'll get right back to media treatment. Some of it surprising of the Second Amendment rally in Richmond coming up. On the Michael Medved Show, the gun rally in Virginia is based upon the fact that the current Democratic governor, Governor Northam, who you remember had a little bit of a problem with blackface, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Governor Northam basically has indicated a willingness to sign a bunch of gun regulation bills. And the kind of bills that he's getting ready to sign are bills that, unless you are a gun owner you probably think, oh, well, so. But bills that, for instance, restrict individuals to buying only one gun per month. And the response, honestly, of a peaceful, law-abiding, sane gun owners is, if I want to buy two guns in the same day, in the same visit to a gun store or a gun show, it's my business. It's not the business of the state of Virginia, Commonwealth of Virginia. But people who came out peacefully, respectfully, waving American flags, and even cleaned up after themselves. I mean, there were people who did litter patrols afterward, which you will never, ever find at the Women's March or left-wing rallies. But it's a characteristic of conservative rallies. This is the way their gathering in Richmond, Virginia, was portrayed in the media. This is a collage compiled by Newsbusters. Listen.
Right now, thousands of gun rights activists, white nationalists, militia groups, all swarming the Virginia state capitol.
There are a lot of people nervous about what's going to happen.
Authorities in Richmond are on high alert.
It could be a tense day.
Such polarization. What may happen in Virginia?
Several hate groups, supposedly some white nationalists.
White nationalists.
White nationalists.
White nationalists.
White nationalist groups.
White supremacists.
White supremacists.
White supremacists, white extremists.
This entire rally stands in opposition to the meaning of this day.
Virginia on the edge.
How concerned are you that there might be some people in this crowd that may want to get violent?
There's certainly a lot of concern here.
Raising fears of a dangerous confrontation.
It could be violence. And there is real concern there.
There's a lot of concern about the potential for violence.
It sparked violence.
Northam clearly trying to avoid another Charlottesville.
Yeah. In Charlottesville.
Could see a repeat of what we saw in 2017 in Charlottesville.
Similar to what we saw in Charlottesville.
Worrying about a repeat of Charlottesville.
Horrible 2017 Charlottesville disaster.
You look at what happened in Charlottesville.
The two sides clashed in Charlottesville.
Men walked through the Capitol in Virginia carrying weapons of war.
Many demonstrators are, in fact, heavily armed.
Heavily, heavily armed.
Heavily armed. Look at the gear.
What is this all about?
Militia groups. Armed militia.
These militia groups.
Far-right militias.
Militia.
Militia groups.
Far-right extremists.
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 Okay, with all of that, listen to the last report. Actually, this is also from mainstream media. A summary about what the actual rally was like. Listen.
Look, those threats which caused the governor to call for a state of emergency have simply not emerged. The police very clear in saying that they have not had a single arrest during this rally.
Okay, and it was entirely peaceful. Now, a lot of people did carry guns. Guns were banned on the Capitol grounds. Jeremy Northam, the governor, made an emergency declaration. Emergency declaration banning people from actually carrying the weapons onto the Capitol grounds. And it wasn't just guns. It was pikes and spears and bows and arrows and a whole range of weapons. And okay, I would submit that one of the reasons that things probably went well is Antifa recognizing that the people in the Second Amendment rally would be fairly well armed, said, we're not going to come out and try to beat up these people. In other words, it was not peaceful in spite of the fact that many of the participants were carrying legally, but because of it, at least in part. There were a number of prominent African-American individuals who were included in the rally, despite all the talk of white supremacism. And one of the clips that actually made it through the media shows a white participant asking a black participant about, well, whether he's a white supremacist. Listen.
Are you a white supremacist?
Yeah. Am I a white supremacist?
I was told there'd be
this
white
ain't
supremacists.
This ain't me, I got dreads.
Oh, wow, you really are blackface. Like,
United we stand,
that's
brother.
That's right, brother.
Yes, sir. Yeah. United we stand. But they mad because there wasn't no civil unrest. Now they going to be mad because there wasn't no fight. Oh, yeah. Now they going to be mad because then nobody get locked up. They going to be mad because all the officers is at peace. They going to be mad because ain't nobody out here fighting. They mad, but guess what? United we stand. That's what this was about.
That's right, brother.
I'm from St. Louis, and I ain't even had to bring no weapon. Don't need no weapon. Don't none of us need no weapon, but we got them.
We got it.
We
back.
Got them. We got each other back. Why? Because united we stand. That's what it's about.
That's right.
Amen.
United we stand.
That's right, bro. That's right.
White, black, that's Hispanic, right. Latino, here, Mexican, whatever. United we stand. They not finna make this no communist state. They not finna make us no felons. They not finna turn off law enforcement officers against us just because y'all on some nonsense.
Okay, united we stand. And they did use some inflammatory language at one point in the demonstration. Listen. And by the way, it was a huge crowd. They recited the pledge, and they also picked up litter. Listen.
Let's pick up the trash. We're going to put it right here in this bag. It's a birthday present for Ralph Northam.
Yeah.
All right. There we go. I got some over here. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. And there was one congressional candidate, African-American guy. His name is Jeffrey Dove. He's a Republican. He talked about the significance of the rally in Richmond.
I am here in Richmond, Virginia at the Second Amendment rally. You can see how many people are here. Got my friend Jimmy Singh here. Look at this crowd. This is what freedom of speech is about. This is what this country is about. We will not bend to the Democrats. We will not bend to Governor Northam and his ridiculous legislation that they are trying to push to limit the rights of law-abiding citizens in this country. We will not bend. We will stand and we will fight against this.
Amen, brother.
Come out. See us down here in Richmond. We'll be here all morning. Come support the Second Amendment.
Not only support the Second Amendment, but support the changing the image of what it means to be a conservative. And if you compare the rally in Richmond to the various women's rallies, the lack of hysteria, the lack of hatred, of fanaticism, the Richmond rally, it appears, now I wasn't there, but the way it's covered, even on MSNBC and CNN, it looks like it was a tremendous success. And congratulations to the leaders who helped to keep it that way. When we come back, we have two extraordinary guests. Daniel Henninger, who is one of my favorite columnists, he's a regular columnist in Wall Street Journal, wrote an explosive column about the way that an apparent change in black voting patterns, at least according to numerous polls, indicating that there's rising black support for Donald J. Trump, could actually remake American politics from the ground up. It's a very important change. Part of that change is also involves a group called MAGA Black. The leader, one of the founders of that group, is James Golden, talk show host, best known as Bo Snerdly, who produces the Rush Limbaugh Show every day. James will also be joining us on the Michael Medved Show to talk about a potential political earthquake, if it happens. And why is it happening in this greatest nation on God's green earth?
The patriarchy, Donald Trump, Mike Pence, white supremacy,